You're listening to the Doctor Who Review Show 2015.
So what blew you away about that?
I feel like you should answer first the hymn, since you usually do.
All of it. I thought it was excellent.
The point where I felt like the highest moment of excitement and awe was basically similar to Claire's reaction when she steps out of the TARDIS, looking out a window and realizing that they're underwater, surrounded by an abandoned, submerged village. It's so eerie and the perfect setting for a ghost story.
It might be a strange thing to be blown away by, but for me it was the pacing. Sure, it's a two-part story, so you kind of hope it won't be all rush, rush, rush and ignoring character development, but even with 90 minutes to tell the story, I feel this first part really throttled back.
It was classic based on the Siege, and I really think it worked well. There was a genuine sense of jeopardy, and the characters all felt so beautifully drawn, but it just was a really strong story, a really strong cast and fantastic direction, and probably my favourite Capaldi episode so far.
The chase, when they were chasing the ghosts through all the corridors, that was really exciting.
What blew me away in that episode? I loved the line about peanut allergies. As ever, Clara blew me away in that episode. She's very nice, isn't she?
What didn't do it for you? The only bit I'd say is the ending.
Yeah, the ending. I feel like the ending, it's difficult to judge these things, because when you try and judge something, you got to remember that it is designed for people younger than you.
I can imagine there'll be a few sleepless nights around the country.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't think there was anything that stood out as not doing it for me. It was all very good. You can't fault it for being a part one, but at the same time, it's hard to judge it as a complete story.
Of all the things that bothered me, I think the one that sticks out in my mind the most is probably the most insignificant detail, really. Even though Lun was on board to sign, it really irritated me that a commanding officer would chew gum when his second-in-command is deaf and, as we later discover, a proficient lip-reader.
You know, I'm not rapt with the way the end of The Magician's Apprentice was basically Clara and Missy are dead, and now the end of Under the Lake is basically the Doctor is dead.
The four words, the dark, the forsaken, the sword, the temple, worst directions ever.
The other big thing is that I question Clara's work ethic. I have no idea how she's still employed by Coal Hill School.
I've got a question here that I'm not expecting you to answer, which is what raised questions?
That just raises further questions.
What raised questions for me? Well, take your pick. How does the Doctor get out of becoming a ghost? Are the two people he takes back with him to the past brown bread as well once that dam breaks?
So I think the biggest question obviously has to be who or what is in the box. The Doctor seems an obvious choice. Is it a monoid? Is it Danny Pink? Is it a cat? And if so, is the cat alive?
What raised questions for me? Well, the whole thing was a big series of what's this, what are they saying, what are they made of, why can they touch metal, how are they controlling the base, what's the writing on the... It was just a big carnival of questions designed to pass 45 minutes quite excitingly.
Okay, so my question is, are they ever going to explain to us why these guys can only pick up metal? That is my question. Because it was brought up, but it really was never truly answered. I hope they go back and explain that.
The man who did the sign language, why was he saved? Why didn't the ghost kill him with the spanner? We didn't actually get the answer, and my only thinking is that he is a translator for them because they couldn't be heard and she can't hear, and he's the missing link between the two, I think.
One of the best things about the last 3 weeks of Doctor Who, I think, is that we've had two cliffhangers, which these days is quite a lot to have within that short space of time. The cliffhanger is a real kind of cornerstone of what Doctor Who was like growing up with it in the fag end of the classic era. And since the show's come back, they've been used sparingly, sometimes to great effect, sometimes not so much. Revenge of the Cybermen, Age of Steel. Oh dear. But I thought it would be a good time to think back and look at some of the all-time great cliffhangers Doctor Who has featured over the years. I suppose three that stand out to me are all sort of united by they've got the Doctor kind of losing his rag a little bit. So, I mean, most people would look at the end of the Caves of Androzani, episode 3, where you've got the Doctor exactly 25 minutes from death, handcuffed to a chair on a flight deck. He's sort of hijacked the ship he's supposed to be a prisoner on. He's flying it directly at Androzani Minor, and the villain of the scene is kind of cutting his way through the door to get in there and stop the Doctor, and the Doctor's just having none of it, and he's strapped in that chair, staring into the camera, going, "You see, I'm not going to let you stop me now." And then that music kicks in with that scream, and it's just very exciting. And that kind of makes the point of a cliffhanger. It doesn't always have to end with the Doctor slash his companion standing there with someone's pointing a gun at them, or someone's brandishing an axe at them, or someone saying, "Kill them." It doesn't have to stop the story on an artificial moment of extreme peril just so we can, you know, crash zoom into Colin Baker's jowls as he goes, "Perry." You know, sometimes if a story reaches a point where you just don't want to leave it at that moment, if indeed at all ever, but you certainly can't be torn away from what's happening on the screen right there and then, that's the moment to do it. And that's what makes a really good cliffhanger. Another one in that same kind of genre would be from the end of Bad Wolf, where the Christopher Eccleston Doctor has just discovered that Rose is still alive. He thought she was killed by the Daleks, but she was teleported to their ship. Suddenly, he's looking out across space, and the myriad ships of the Dalek fleet are slowly, one by one, revealed to him. And it's a terrible moment because he was kind of rattled by the idea that one Dalek survived the Time War. Now he's confronted by the fact that there are millions of Daleks and they've got Rose, and he doesn't have a plan. All he can do is sort of stare icily down into the camera and shout at them and tell Rose not to worry, he's coming for her and he's going to blow every damn lousy Dalek out of the sky. And that was a real goosebumpy moment, not just for the Daleks, but also for me. And every time I watch that, it has the same effect. And I've watched it probably about 13, 14 times by now over the last 10 years. Another great Doctor-led cliffhanger would be from Time of the Angels. It features Matt Smith being chased through a labyrinth by weeping angels, and the little sort of ragtag party of people he's leading look like they're kind of trapped. They're out in the middle of nowhere. It's getting dark. They're pretty much doomed. And the Doctor, who's in conversation with a weeping angel at this point, sort of stares icily up and says, "If you want to live, there's one thing you do not do. There's one thing you do not put in a trap. Me." And shoots his gun, and that kind of implies that he's got a plan. And at that moment, he goes from being like a sort of passenger in the chase to, oh, he's got a plan, he knows what he's doing, oh, this is cool. And that was something that the Matt Smith Doctor was especially good at, suddenly going from being kind of a sort of affable goon in the corner to suddenly drawing on the millennia of wisdom and experience he had, and just really icily looking like he knew exactly how to destroy you. The other of the two possible things that can happen in a cliffhanger, the other side is that the Doctor or his companion are in great peril. And there have been some really standout cliffhangers in that genre. So, I mean, I can still remember being incredibly young, at the end of Remembrance of the Daleks Part 1, which was first broadcast in 1988 when I was the size of a grape. I was so young. And you've got Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred charging up some stairs in a cellar towards the door, which is suddenly locked from above. And they turn around in horror, and there's a Dalek. And for the first time ever on TV, its base kind of glows red, and the thing starts floating up the stairs towards them. And the Doctor realises, seemingly for the first time, that the Daleks can get upstairs, and he's going to look a lot less smug in about 3 seconds' time when it blows his face off. Another one comes from the much lambasted Colin Baker era, the end of Mark of the Rani Part 1. The Doctor finds himself, for some reason, strapped to a sort of medical gurney. He's being pushed around a bit because I think the Master or the Rani fancied going for a Sunday afternoon walk. I forget the exact plot mechanics, but there's a disturbance, and the Master or the Rani or whoever are sort of distracted, and the Doctor goes, "Perry, quick, push," and Perry, being Perry, pushes him down the hill rather than up the hill. I don't know quite how the Sixth Doctor was expecting anyone to push him up a hill on a metal table, least of all a little frail young thing like Perry. I mean, maybe if Brian Blessed and Jeff Capes had been there, that might have worked. Anyway, he's charging down the hill, strapped to a table, absolutely powerless. Anything could go wrong. He could fall over. It could go into an oncoming tram or horse, because we're back in the 1800s. But instead, it finds its way brilliantly onto some pit rails and heads towards an open mine shaft at sort of 30 or 40 miles an hour, which was a really memorable cliffhanger when I was small and tiny. And another very memorable cliffhanger comes from the end of Dragonfire Part 1, and it's kind of gone down in the annals of Doctor Who history for the wrong reasons. But the Doctor is walking along in the catacombs of Iceworld. He's at the side of a massive sort of crevasse on a little pathway. He looks down, and in the book it is explained that he can see another path a little way below him, and the one he's on is running out, so he decides to climb over the edge. On the TV show, that isn't made clear, and he just climbs over the edge of the crevasse and dangles from his umbrella and slowly starts to sort of sink down the umbrella. I'm struggling because otherwise I'm about to use the word shaft and then I think we'd all start sniggering. He's dangling from his brolly and slipping down it, and below him is certain frozy, icy death. When I was like, I don't know, 10, or it was an absolutely brilliant cliffhanger, and it's only when you look at it on TV through the eyes of an adult that you begin to question, if the Doctor's that clever, why is he doing that? The fool. So those would be, I think, my favourite or most memorable cliffhangers growing up, as I did in the 80s. No doubt many of you who remember the 70s will be laughing into your cornflakes or your dinner and saying, oh, he's forgotten all the cliffhangers from the Philip Hinchcliffe era. Oh, the Graham Williams era had the best cliffhangers. Oh, it was all about John Pertwee's big twitching face. Whatever. Everyone has their favourite moments in Doctor Who, and these, I'm very much afraid, are some of mine, and you're just going to have to like it. Oh, did I mention the end of Earthshock Part 1?
I'm very well because I watched Doctor Who.
You didn't.
I did.
That's blooming marvellous. I watched Doctor Who as well.
What are the chances?
I can see you're holding a pen, which means you've got notes and a list. I can't wait to see what's on your list.
I can't get my head around the episode. I've been thinking about it all day. It was really intense. And I know we try and do quirky and fun things, but it was so intense. I got that sucked into the story that
yeah.
I got a bit lost on the quirkiness. I was just, I was intrigued and excited by it.
Last week you said that you were a bit worried because it had ghosts in it. How did you cope?
I was actually genuinely frightened, and I watched it at bedtime.
Oh, no.
I know, and I had to turn the light out. I didn't like that at all. Because I think it actually was. That's frightening. It's been a long time since Doctor Who's frightened me in that way. I think it was genuinely quite scary.
But the other thing is, though, this is what kids need, though, because you had a cliffhanger in it, and that's the problem with new Doctor Who, is sometimes it's just 45 minutes long, so, you know, you've got a beginning, you're safe by the end. With this one, that image is left in your head for a week of the Doctor with his eyes spooned out.
Spinning water,
and all those children, that's what their vision is in their heads for a week.
Almost worth having kids just to watch them squirm. I know that I'm frightened, and I'm a fully grown adult.
Yes, you are. Well, speaking of ghosts and spotting quirky things, so there's a bit in it where they're trying to, when they're trying to trap the ghosts, aren't they?
Yes, I like that bit.
So they're basically running around a maze, which is the underwater base. So they're running around a maze, chasing three ghosts. Does that remind you of anything?
Yes!
So,
exciting, it's Pac-Man!
Yeah, so this whole episode's based on Pac-Man. Those ghosts had funny eyes, didn't they? Do you know what those ghosts have got names, haven't they? Other three ghosts or four?
Yeah, they're called something like Inky and Pinky and stuff like that.
Inky, Blinky and Pinky, but I think they introduced a fourth ghost at one time that was just called something like Nigel or something. I can't remember. Inky, Pinky, Blinky and Nigel.
Nigel. Well, taking one for the normal boys out there.
The other quirky thing was, of course, which is quite funny, and I could do with these sometimes, the Doctor has cards with things written on.
Yeah, Willy Wonka has them in the latest Tim Burton version of Willy Wonka.
Another movie reference. This is great. We're getting movie reference every week. So we've got Pac-Man and Willy Wonka this week.
There was an Indiana Jones moment as well where we had to slide underneath the door. And I thought, wouldn't it be good if he had a hat? They had ship reminded me of Red Dwarf, because there was a big canteen, but there was only about five members of staff.
Last week, there was the one chair on Skara.
Yes!
The chairs this week, those are the chairs that are in the BBC centre in Hull. So if there's a corporate style across all BBC centres, basically they nicked the chairs out of BBC Wales for the day.
That's fantastic.
Which means no one could sit down and after dinner in BBC Wales because Doctor Who had nicked them for the set of a submarine base.
That's fantastic. Well, last week there was a design classic, and this week those chairs I think are done by Ray and Charles Eames.
Yeah.
Two designer chairs we've had this series already, which is a good...
This is definitely the series for chairs, yeah. Of course, I'll tell you something else that was funny. He couldn't get Peter Andre's mysterious girl out of his head for 2 weeks.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah. Should we just sing a bit of that, maybe? And that will... If you sing along with it, I'll seamlessly merge us into the actual song as we fade out.
That's beautiful. Okay. You start.
I don't know if I know the words, but I'll try it. Oh, mysterious girl, I wanna make love to you. Is that it?
G'day everyone, Dr. Robert here with the test results for Under the Lake. Take a seat, this won't take long. First up, let's talk about this story's writer, Toby Whithouse. Going into this episode, I knew Whithouse for writing the episodes School Reunion, Vampires of Venice, The God Complex, and A Town Called Mercy. All of these, it must be said, had interesting ideas, but it was only really The God Complex that stood out for me in years past. I thought it was really, really good. And yes, before you think I'm a heartless bastard, I did like School Reunion too for the Sarah Jane factor and just the feels overall. But it wasn't a great story per se. Vampires and A Town Called Mercy, meanwhile, didn't do much for me at all, and both are stories I'd never miss if I never saw them again. So I came to this episode thinking, imaginative writer, he's thrilled me in the past. He's also let me down in the past. So, cutting to the chase, what did he do for me this time around? Well, he produced a winner, ladies and gentlemen, pure and simple. And like the previous story this series, I think we've had a real treat in the first half of the tale, but I feel the second part is going to outdo the first, because I think this was a really great example of the first half of a story really taking its time to flesh things out and only going so far, leaving some real quality moments for the second part, which, as we've seen, appears to largely take place before the first episode begins. I love that sort of thing, and I'm really surprised Doctor Who doesn't do more of it. Maybe lesser writers have felt it's too much of a cheat, i.e. you put your characters in a bad spot, then send them back into the past to fix it. In the hands of a good writer, however, and I think Whithouse is a good writer, it could be really, really great. Now, clearly I like this episode from everything I've just said, but there were still some puzzlers in it for me. And here's an example of one. Why was Pritchard outside scuba diving for the missing energy source? Yeah, I get he was the greedy oil exec and, you know, he really, really, really would have liked that new energy source, but what on earth suggested it might be outside just randomly floating around? There was nothing in the story, that I caught at least, which suggested that at all. It came across just as a very clumsy way to position him in that airlock where he could be drowned. You know, even if there was a line earlier in the episode like, oh, someone's opened such and such airlock, or something that suggested material might have been jettisoned out of the base by an unknown party, it would have at least given him the idea that he needed to go outside to look for that energy source, and a plausible reason for us as the audience as to why this, you know, scared little guy was doing what he did in the middle of the base being attacked by these strange ghosts. Because when you think about it, why would you go outside to look for that thing? Wouldn't you search the base first? I don't know. Anyway, the Doctor and Clara were very good in this episode, as I've been hoping they would be this whole series. Ever since we had word that this would be, you know, their golden years, their salad days, this series, a time where they're just out and about and having a great time, I've been really hopeful of less, oh, I'll smack you so hard you regenerate nonsense, and just basically more fun. And lines like, was it something she said? She does that. She once had an argument with Gandhi. You know, were just brilliant, as were the cue cards that Clara shuffled to give the Doctor the right response to the base dwellers at one point. It highlighted in just, you know, a single moment that he's alien and she's not. In a similar way, I was really happy with the support cast. They had just the right amount of fear and desire to get away at first, which was slowly being swung around by the presence of the Doctor to wanting to stay and sort things out. In a single episode, that kind of turnaround might have felt rushed and probably unbelievable, but not here. It felt quite natural. Before I close out for this week, here's an interesting thing to consider as we look ahead to the next episode. Prior to this episode going out, there was a bit of a buzz on social media and in the wider mainstream media that Slipknot's Corey Taylor supplies the voice to a character called the Fisher King. Now, I think these stories in the media probably broke a little early, as the Fisher King character wasn't in this episode at all, but he will be in the next episode. Me, myself, I had vague memories of the Robin Williams movie The Fisher King, and also as a bit of an Arthurian legend buff, I could remember a little about the character from legend. So I did a little research to refresh my memory about the Fisher King, and what do you know? The Fisher King first appears in Percival from the late 12th century, but the character's roots may lie in Celtic mythology. He may derive more or less directly from the figure of Bran the Blessed. Bran had a cauldron, you see, that could resurrect the dead, albeit imperfectly because those he revived with the cauldron couldn't speak. Now let's stop there for a moment. Reviving the dead, but they can't speak? Anyway, Bran gave the cauldron to the King of Ireland as a wedding gift for him and Bran's sister Branwen when they got married. Later, however, Bran waged war on the Irish. He was wounded in the foot or the leg, opinions vary, and the cauldron was destroyed. Now, maybe that story veers off a little and isn't all being used as background in Doctor Who. I'm not sure how it could be, actually. But I was struck by the idea of something resurrecting people but not giving them the power of speech. Pretty interesting stuff, hey? Finally, the question must be asked, though. Who is in the box, if not the pilot of the alien spacecraft? It certainly seems a good way for the Doctor to suddenly reappear in the present, i.e. the world of the first episode, if we think he's died in the past, i.e. in the world of the second episode. Or is that what we're just supposed to think, and there'll be some further twist involving that box? It's obviously important in some way. The question is whether it's in the most obvious way or not. Okay, and that's me done for the week. Like the Dalek two-parter, I'll give an overall score once we see part two. Suffice to say, for the week ahead, I'm loving it. Being with a friend, I said you called up a robber.
Hi, it's Al, and with me is...
Andy, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Absolutely fine.
Right, excellent. So let's dive straight into Under the Lake.
Yes.
That was an accidental. When I say dive in, you know, take your shoes off, throw them in. So, have you got a question?
I have got a question, yes. And it's basically after 2 weeks of Daleks, Davros, Masters, Skara, and, you know, time paradoxes and all that malarkey, yeah. Which a lot of people are saying is fan service, is the terminology I've heard put about. I would like to say, do you feel that this episode was fan service, Al?
This episode was fan service?
Yes, the one we've just had.
Yes, I do. I think that this episode was fan service in that it gave the fans what they need, not what they want, which is a much more important way of going about making a programme like Doctor Who, which the fans should have absolutely no control over at any stage. And that there's enough of the kisses to the past. It's nice that you've got fans in charge who love the show and who want it to stay there and everything, but personally, I prefer it when it's being run by... obviously, you've got fans who are television professionals, but as with sort of all things, I'm going to come back to and quote Des Skin here, which is never aim it at the fans, because they'll buy it anyway. And it's nice putting in little kisses to the fans and kisses to the past and all sorts of stuff like that, but no, just do it... I mean, because this has got echoes of Doctor Who, because we've got references to Sarah Jane, Hand of Fear, you've got references to all sorts of things going off on it, but it's... Yeah, this is what Doctor Who should be about. It's about moving forward, not looking back.
To me, I feel that it was fan service, but done properly, as you say. But my it goes off into two different directions here. One notion is that it's been crafted by a chef with subtle flavours and ingredients and hints of things that you don't necessarily know are in the mix. Whereas something like the Dalek episode, the Witch's Apprentice and the Magician's Familiar, whatever they were called. That was the other way around. Meh, sorry, out in the edit. They seemed to be sort of like just, a cut-price, own brand lasagna, if you like. All packed together, not very carefully. It needs seasoning. Chuck in a bit of salt, that'll do the job. Yeah, it needs subtle ingredients. Yeah, put chicken beaks in it. It's sort of, to me, it's the difference between a chef-crafted item, which was the episode we had this week, and the off the shelf, not very nicely crafted element, we should say. So I know there was an interview with Stephen Moffat when he'd done The Curse of Fatal Death back in his days of comic relief, and he said he'd sort of gone and asked a few people, whether he did or not, I don't know, but he claimed he'd asked people, what are the key ingredients of Doctor Who when you think about it? And he said people had said, oh, there's Daleks, and they're always with the Master, oh, and there's Davros. So it seems like he's not fan service, he's just taken the bits that the general public has put with Doctor Who, because for fans it raised questions like, why is that Dalek going around on Skara when it's obviously a dead planet Dalek and should be confined to the city? It raises questions like that to fans. Whereas what last night's episode did to me is it reminded me of things like Ark in Space, and it reminded me of Robots of Death, and it gave me those little twinges inside me thinking, this is how you make Doctor Who.
Yes.
This is what you do.
And it was, yes, yeah, definitely. Would you like an actual quote from Stephen Moffat from Doctor Who Magazine 278, which was to do with the production of...
Have you got it there?
Yeah, I have. Okay, he said, it's like, it was, how can we make a version of Doctor Who which lots of people will watch that doesn't cost a lot of money? While I would love to be involved in such a project, I think you probably need people who are not fans. I think non-fans should make an awful lot of the artistic decisions about it and dispose of the notion of canon once and for all. I suspect, because every creative team which takes over should be left to do their own version. And I felt that what we saw with Under the Lake was that's the first proper Peter Capaldi as a Doctor episode, in a way, where we actually see, right, this is how this is going to be done. There were a couple that came a little bit close to it last year, but not to the extent of this. I think I thought that was the best episode of Doctor Who that we have had in a long time.
Well, it's because you didn't have any worry about complicated or semi-complicated backstories with Clara or the Doctor on a quest to find out whether he was good or not. And, you know, they were just the Doctor and the Companion, and they were put in a situation and the story's off and running.
In many ways, though, weirdly, it felt more like a traditional episode. Because when they used to start, you'd be thinking, like, when you'd have episode one, thousands of years ago when I was a kid, you'd be desperately trying to work out what on earth was going on and how all this stuff was going to connect and how it was all going to pull together.
Mm.
And that's been missing for a long... In fact, that's almost been missing since The God Complex, oddly enough, which, of course, was also written by Toby Whithouse.
It was. Now, while you're mentioning Toby Whithouse, this sort of like, you know, now this is going to be a little bit iffy, this, because I'm going to have to mention next week. But only briefly, but next week's is set before... It's in a different order, isn't it? The Doctor's going backwards.
Yes.
So basically, is this the first example of timey-wimey has been used by a writer that isn't Stephen Moffat in the new series?
That's difficult.
As a big plot device, I think it is.
I think it probably is.
I just think that's an interesting thing that this was, you know, it was Stephen Moffat's thing when he was writing his RTD episodes, and of course he was going to make it a bigger thing when he became the showrunner. But you hear people often say, "Who's the new Stephen Moffat? Who's bringing the little thing to it?" Nobody would touch the kind of stories he did. But now we've sort of got this where somebody is daring to go into that territory.
Yeah, well, the nearest thing to it was probably The Next Doctor, but it kind of fumbled out of it, where you'd be running into a future incarnation of the Doctor.
Mm.
That would be one way of doing it. But the series has done this before, but what it's actually done when it did it before, it did it in chronological order, and it did that in the arc, where the story jumps in the middle a huge amount, and you find out what happens in the future. Whereas this way, by doing it backwards, where you find out what happens in the future first, and then the past, I'm just surprised it's taken this long to do that sort of a story, because it seems really obvious. I know that might sound a bit weird, but it does seem like a really obvious way of doing it.
It does.
Yeah.
Here's a couple of interesting things. One about the past, and one about the future. I think, right. So this is set a little bit in the future. This episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they're aware of UNIT, and they mention UNIT.
Yes. Yeah.
Is this going to play into something? Do you think?
This is a 12-part series.
Yeah, I thought this might go with your theory. Yeah.
Everything's connected. Definitely. Yeah, it's going to build up because you've got the whole, you know, people knowing who the Doctor is, and there being no kind of question in UNIT being much, much bigger. Yeah, I think so.
It sounds almost scary, like UNIT's become a much bigger, scarier organisation, possibly. Who knows?
Something that's a bit weird as well is that Under the Lake, if Before the Flood comes off okay, the events of Under the Lake will be all rewritten.
They will, won't they?
Yeah.
Oh,
and that's quite cool.
It is. The other thing that struck me slightly is that we've got some Zygons coming up in the series.
Yes.
And last time we were underwater and drilling for oil, weren't Zygons involved?
And in Scotland.
In Scotland, absolutely, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, but which is weird, because you think the loch is a bit full, though, already, isn't it? Because you've got... you've got the Borad in there, and you've got the Scarisons still wandering around, lactating all over the place. So, you know, it's a bit grim.
Another thing that I noticed as well that I thought was interesting, because we're of an age, Al.
Oh, well, yes.
And when we discuss fan service, we bring up things like Tom Baker and Genesis of the Dalek and the Ark in space, and we bring up things like that, and good old Base Under Siege.
Oh,
we,
yes. Yeah.
We discuss things like that. But, of course, this new Who, as they like to call it, has been about for 10 years now.
Yeah.
And it's got its own set of fans. And I thought it's very interesting that this is also a hat tip to all of the other base ones we've had, the Sanctuary base ones and all the Ood ones. And
it felt very much like the Satan Pit.
Yeah, and I thought it's sort of like that's almost fan service to the people who've been following it since it came back.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Because you've got because Scooty bounced off the
that's
window,
it, yeah.
Didn't she?
Yeah, and, so absolutely.
Untranslatable things.
Yes, exactly. Yes, so it's starting to tip its hat to elements of its recent past to us, ancient past to some of these youngsters, I should think.
Yeah, I think so. There's it continues the Stephen Moffat Something in Your Eye motif as well. You know, with to do with eyes and sound and communication, and which was kind of an obvious thing. But eyes have been something that he's really run with since he took over. There might be a little bit of a double bluff going on with this one as well, because we know that the Doctor's now a ghost, which means that the process will have to be reversible.
Yes.
And we also know that Clara's infected.
I never saw that cliffhanger coming, Al.
Did you not?
I'm being sarcastic.
Oh, right, okay. That's
okay. I knew that would have to be the Doctor or Clara in that situation, the cliffhanger. But the problem is, we do know there's more episodes to come, and we've seen the clips in the trailer, so
yeah,
we know it's going to resolve. Interesting, how is it going to be resolved, obviously?
Yes, yeah.
Yes. I just want to mention, as quite often I do, design.
Oh, good, yes.
And I have to... I was watching it again today, and there's just little details on that set.
Beautiful.
That no one would ever have thought of doing in an old episode of Doctor Who. Just where, you know, things look a little bit worn out and there's mould growing and there's obviously bits of damp have got in or things have leaked. It's just absolutely stunning, the job that's done on that set.
Exquisitely done. In the Faraday chamber, where they've all got the sleeping bags and each person's got like slightly different things next to them that they've taken their own stuff. It was beautiful. The set design was excellent. I thought the directing was really good. There's some very clever shots in it.
Well, quite a restricted set as well.
Oh, yeah. But this is beautifully filmed.
You think this is... strange comparison to make to it, but this isn't dissimilar to the... Which is the one from the Sylvester McCoy with the Kangs in it? Is that Paradise Towers?
Oh, yeah. Red Kangs being best.
Yeah, that is very much a stage set. With corridors, and it's you can see that it's a tight, small set, whereas this one is a tight, small set, but the way that it's used and the angles and things, you get the idea. And the cuts to the exterior, of course, make it look a much bigger, more lavish thing. It's very cleverly done.
The nearest thing in the series to it, where you've got underwater things that reference alien films, it would was Cold War, and I thought that this was much more successful than Cold War.
I actually felt this was a lot like Cold War for me, because the last time I got those feelings of, oh my god, this is how Doctor Who used to be, was Cold War.
Right.
That was a personal thing, but I think I just like the confined space, and I think it had a lot jazzier lighting, did Cold War. It was a little bit more poppy, shall I say.
Yeah.
Whereas this is slightly more... This is more real.
Can we say something about how brilliant the acting was as well, please? Because it
absolutely
was uniformly excellent throughout. It's such a treat to be able to just sort of go, yeah, you've knocked that one out of the park. Well done. Congratulations to the lot of you.
Yes. Two bits about performance, though, which is interesting. Thing one, we need to mention the Doctor's cards about saying the right thing in the right situation.
Exquisite, yeah.
Yeah. Did you get a chance to read what it said on any of the other ones?
Yeah, well, that's where you got the Sarah Jane reference, haven't you, about the Aberdeen dropping off. And
I thought they were really good, and I did like the Doctor's delivery of that. I was a little bit thrown at the beginning of the episode, because I've always been a Clara fan, and I've always liked her. And when I see people saying things like, "Oh, she's a moaner, she's a whinger, she does this, and that, she's too big for her boots," and I never see it. Whereas at the beginning of this episode, I thought it was very strange that she seemed a bit out of character to me, wanting to, you know, chasing the adrenaline of wanting to get on with the adventure and the danger and You know, I think Harry's story is a bit more caring than that.
Clara's tragic character arc that should have ended last year and didn't. I think that Stephen Moffat has taken the opportunity to develop it and push it further, so that what we're seeing now is we're really seeing her start to go too far. Because yes. Last time when she lied to Danny, and that was what kicked the whole thing off. But this is still an echo of all these things. It's not going to end well. It's not going to be good, because she looks after him. Okay, the whole duty of care thing with the cards, which is beautiful, because what that does is it reinforces the notion that he is a god who does not know how to behave with these weird, flitty, flickering life forms that travel back and forth around him really quickly. Because the doctors, it's like Terry Pratchett had a thing about the way that people perceive time is different. It's like maybe creatures and animals and things perceive time separately. So possibly you end up with elderly mayflies hanging around discussing how youngsters these days ain't got no respect. Whereas possibly an oak tree's only got enough time to notice the way the sky keeps flickering before it dies.
Well,
and that is kind of the way that I think that the Doctor travels through everything. You know, people that encounter him are almost like ghosts, you know, within the Time Lord life, because the lifespan is so long that you can, you know, these people, he remembers them all, but he forgets. Well, what was it? He can forget stuff because that amount of time is incredible. But he is basically, he's removed and he becomes like a god. But Clara,
yes. He'd forgotten how to do sign language, hadn't he?
Yeah, he had.
This episode, that's right.
Yes, which was nice.
He could remember semaphore.
Yeah, that was quite good. I wonder if they do it with Wuthering Heights. But Clara, that discussion in the TARDIS, she totally misinterpreted what he was saying. He was warning her that she's going too far. That was something. You're right. She's building it up. It's an adrenaline junkie. The problem is that people, it becomes, you push, if you're into that sort of thing, into sort of extreme sports and extremely dangerous things, they end up getting pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed until people just don't come back.
Yeah, well, possibly then it is more subtle than I was thinking, because the last time this happened was when the Tenth Doctor and Rose were heading towards Rose going, and they were being hubris. Full of themselves, weren't they? And
yeah.
That was quite badly done. But then again, the Russell T. Davies was popping up on Doctor Who Extra every week going, oh, this is where they get too big for their boots, and, you know.
Well, you're right, that's the same sort of thing, because that's what was going on, because we were seeing the problems that Clara was having last year, you know, with trying to balance all these different commitments and having this incredible lifestyle and turning up drenched for dates and so on and being exhausted. But she'll be aging at a different speed to everyone else as well. And the time is going to come when she's going to go back and there will be no job.
Well, you say she's got a duty of care to the Doctor, but it doesn't make her a professional teacher, does it, Al?
No, it doesn't at all. And she's incredibly selfish and has been right the way through. But that's, as a character, I think the way Jenna Coleman's playing is brilliant. And the way it's really interesting that you've got these kind of potential consequences coming up, and it could get quite gruesome.
Yeah, definitely. Do you know what I liked about this episode is because you didn't know what to expect. You knew what you were getting with the last two. It was a Dalek story, so you sort of basically knew the ingredients. You'd be excited and look forward to it, but ultimately it's a Dalek story. Will you be disappointed? But this, you just didn't know what was coming, and you didn't know what was going to happen. And when I saw the next time trailer, I didn't know that. Yeah, it's before it floods. Wow, we get to see some action in a village. Tom Baker again.
Oh yeah, very.
We're going
very
back to a village with a church.
Terror of the Zygons. It's very
absolutely.
Terror. Yeah.
I'm excited about it. Yeah.
But not only that, we've had a major guest star who hasn't had a line yet, and whose name hasn't actually been spoken on screen, but has been in the credits with Paul Kay.
Oh yeah.
Who's dressed largely as a Tivolian undertaker.
Yes.
Like, what? We've got. It's like, it's nice that it's not all explained. That there is some mystery there. This is good. The way that this has been done is very, very clever, and it's really gutsy. And not only that, I think next week's is potentially going to be even scarier because Peter Capaldi looks really frightening.
He did what, his eyes spooned out?
Yeah, when he did the scream, that was kind of, whoa. And I think there are probably quite a few sleepless nights and hopefully people cuddle. It's some of the potential following generation may have cuddled in a little closer to parents or grandparents. And
Yeah.
There's... Well, again, that goes back to the good old days, doesn't it? Tom Baker and, you know, Dominic Glynn last week was saying how great it is to have cliffhangers.
Yes.
It's just exciting, isn't it?
It is. And the other thing I like is, I don't know if you've seen this, the reviews that I've read of it and the stuff that I've read since, it's very positive. And that's a treat. Apart from the people who are always going to hate it, just because they always hate it, it's just, which makes you wonder why they watch it. But anyway. But then you've got... Let's hope they don't fumble it.
No, I think I've got good feelings about this.
It's exciting, isn't it?
And I couldn't even contemplate or guess what's going to happen by the end of next week's episode.
I haven't got a clue.
No, which is why I like it. It's mysterious, this one.
Do you think the doctor's in the sarcophagus?
It could be. That'd be good. That Pandorica, that's been done, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you never know.
Could be.
Might be Matt Smith.
Oh no, I don't think Matt Smith's going to turn up until episode 11.
Do you not? Nah. No.
And on that bombshell. Don't phone in, it's not for fun.
Alright guys, I'm here with Alicia and today we're going to be talking about...
We're outside!
Latest episode of Doctor Who, which was Under the Lake.
The one with the loads of water and the loads of creepy things that went blah!
The one with ghosts.
Oh, wait, no, they didn't. They just went.
Okay.
So... No. This is the sound they made. See, that was a really good impression.
That was amazing. They made sounds whatsoever.
I should be on Doctor Who.
Should.
I know.
You're amazing. So, initial reaction, what did you think?
I thought it was really good. Honest opinion, I thought. The ghosts was a really good effect. I liked the fact they made them actually look transparent, which was literally a mysterious element, because I was literally thinking, what are these aliens? And then all of a sudden, you got the doctor going, I don't know what these are. And I'm like, you don't know? No. So what did you think?
I originally thought it was a brilliant concept with the ghost element and having the episode situated and located within an underground location. But... when speaking to a friend, I actually found out it was very similar to The Impossible Planet, which was a story, it was a two-parter with Rose on 10th Doctor and the Ooods.
Oh, yeah, I watched that, yeah.
And it just, to me, it was very, very similar with having a person dead on the outside of the space station. It happened in this episode with the people being possessed and dying. Same happened in this episode with the Rose and the Doctor being... landed and stranded into a place, dragged by the TARDIS. The same happened with this episode.
Except...
and strange markings as well.
Oh, yeah, and strange markings. Except instead of the body being floating into space, you've got it in water.
Yeah.
To be honest, though, I'm pretty sure no one liked that guy. I'm pretty sure when that guy died, everyone was just like, oh, yay, we got rid of the idiot.
But, I mean, I liked it, but I felt it dragged in certain areas. It was a bit slow.
Yeah. At the same time, I was literally... sorry, was I the only one literally looking at Clara going, okay, it's a desert, you've just landed in a nuclear power plant that the TARDIS is literally having a really bad reaction to, and you're going, let's investigate, let's go and hunt monsters!
I think Clara's stupid sometimes.
I mean, yeah, she was stupid. I mean, there was an episode where she had to press a button to get to escape, and she couldn't even do that correctly.
I don't know how the Doctor even can stand her.
I don't. To be honest, I don't even understand how the fandom can stand her sometimes. I really don't.
So, what did you think about the deaf people in the episode? The two... I can't remember the names.
It was one deaf person.
Sign language.
So. I found the concept really good because I thought, oh, the ghosts can't talk. And then I thought, oh, there's a usefulness here!
Yes.
So I was just like,
literally,
oh,
we were both screaming at the TV when watching it, thinking, you can lip read, why aren't you doing that with the ghosts?
Oh yeah, I was even saying, point one of the cameras at the lips. I was literally saying that a load of times. I was even telling you, going, oh my god, chat, wait, she can lip read, she can tell us what they're saying!
Yeah. But,
we can communicate.
I loved the concept. I think she's a great character, the female that is deaf in the episode. I don't know if the actress is actually deaf. I assume she is.
Yeah, I don't know. She could be faking it. If so,
what would you think about having her as a companion?
I think it would be actually a good change for once, because I don't think we've ever had.
I don't think we have. No,
we haven't had someone that's, you know, nothing wrong with it at all. But you know. I think it would be a nice change anyway, because then it's like a new concept of communication between the Doctor. Obviously, you'd have this and he'll go, "Will you stop it? I can't do that."
Yeah.
I can just see these happenings where he passes a drawing board or something, yeah. Just going, just write
everything.
And either that or she'll just throw little airplanes at him with notes and stuff, just going, "Shut up, shut up, we're in danger, shut up, shut up, shut up."
So the cliffhanger, what did you think of it?
I was like, oh, that ain't looking good. That was literally my first reaction in my head. But I'm curious, because I'm thinking, you can't have died, obviously. Is there a bug on my face?
There was, but it's
Ladies
gone.
And gentlemen, there was a bug on my face. but, you know.
We are recording this outside in the rain, currently.
So it looks like we kind of look like we're drunk and talking to our phone. So, you know, it's fine, we look normal.
It's fine. But yeah, the cliffhanger. I was quite intrigued, especially with Clara, thinking, who is that person walking towards the glass?
What's
space
that
station.
Over the hill, is it a monster?
And it just, as soon as I saw it, I thought, oh my god, it's the Doctor. I freaked out completely and I was scared, especially by the black eyes, with Capaldi thinking, oh my god.
I think one of my first reactions was, like I said,
Doctor,
oh my god, this is
scary again.
It was that, and it was also, this ain't looking good. And then my second thought was, I can see the back of his head. If you look through the eyes, you can literally see the back of his head, and it's like, ew.
So, out of 10, what would you give the episode?
1,005,500.
What would that be out of 10?
Don't trick me now.
Go on. Out of 10.
10.55. Doctor Who.
I'd give it...
Smaug.
7.
Oh, okay.
Maybe an 8. Being generous. I think because of the concept.
Why?
Using the concept again from another episode and changing it.
But why?
Because of... using a similar plot line from another episode.
How it's underwater, it's in a nuclear power plant. It was totally different.
It wasn't just the location was different. No, it was in space, the other one.
I know, but that wasn't a mining facility.
I can't remember, and I meant to know Doctor Who.
I think it was a mining facility. This is where the guys just turn around going, no, it wasn't, it was something to do with power.
Right, well, that's all we've got time for, guys, but thank you very much for listening, and thank you for it to Alicia.
Yay, you have been a great host. Goodbye!
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 Hi, it's Al, and I'm here with...
The Hem.
And we've just finished watching Under the Lake.
These names.
What did you think of that, then?
Well, what did you think of that?
It reminded me a bit of the Satan Pit. I liked the base under siege aspect of it. I thought it was incredibly strong. It zipped by very quickly. It was really well written, really well acted, very well directed. Looked great, tense, edge of your seat stuff. I thought the music was really good. I thoroughly enjoyed that. I think that's the best episode that we've had in a long time.
I think I'm too tired to watch these properly.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, but I just don't remember any of it.
I think with this one, because there's a few sort of things that have leaked that I haven't said to you, is that this one's been told part two first. Finally. Let's do a... That's good. I'm pleased.
So finally...
In a time
More
travel.
Than 50 years into a time travel-related show, they're doing something with the fact that it's a time travel-related show.
Well... But the way that it's structured, oddly enough, even though it's a two-parter, it does remind me of another Doctor Who story.
Okay.
It reminds me of The Ark.
Oh, yeah, that was about the only other... That was so long ago.
Yeah.
That one was really good as well.
Uh-huh, yes. Oh, it was good. It was, yes. Well, and the Monoids. I think the Monoids might be coming back because we've seen Monoid hand puppets in The Time of the Doctor.
That was a good one, The Ark, as well.
Yeah.
And the cliffhanger of the statue being finished.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, that was all really good. And the fact that Monoid guy just waited there for him to come back in his chair.
That's very clever, because there's a named character in there, because I don't know if you saw that in the credits. There's a character called Prentice, who we haven't met yet. Although we have met them, we haven't actually met them. I don't know. So, do you think the Doctor's dead?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Uh-huh, okay, right, good. There was a lot to do with sound and vision.
In fact, the second that... there was the ghost out there. I knew it was going to be the Doctor. because that's how it goes.
Well, yeah.
Because it had to be, because the other ones were in the chamber. And, you know, while they could have probably got out through the walls, because I don't really know why they're stuck in that chamber in the first place, do all underwater bases have ghost-proof chambers?
Well, Faraday's a chamber. Yeah, I think so. It comes to standard.
Right. But if it had been one of the, you know, other people that went with him,
yeah,
it doesn't really feel like a cliffhanger. It just feels like a spoiler.
But if it had been all three of them, then...
Oh, yeah, that would have been cool.
Yeah.
But it wasn't.
In fact, that was the only bit that sort of almost didn't work, because, yeah, I knew it was going to be the Doctor as well, because it had to be. Because
it had to be.
Otherwise it doesn't up the jeopardy, because that means that Clara's stuck.
And I feel like it would have worked better, but I don't know, that bit lasted slightly too long. With her going, no.
Yeah, but it wasn't.
No.
But it wasn't.
No.
But it wasn't bad. It wasn't as bad as Aliens of London, was it? Where the endings just never stop.
But that at least had, you know, like five endings. It wasn't like, you know, one ending that was no.
We got the we need to talk line in there, but it didn't go all Walking Dead, which I thought was quite nice. But don't you see, got said twice. I love that. But don't you see? I think that's, yeah, there was some very clever shots in that. The directing, I thought, was... Well, I've said this already, I thought the directing was strong. The Autons and the Nethersphere getting a mention was cool. The Doctor came across as much more alien than he has done in a long time as well. I like the idea that he's got the cards. But it's not just that he's coming across...
There's something bizarre with Peter Capaldi's Doctor.
Are you convinced with him as the Doctor?
Yeah, but he's been written in a really unique way, because he has almost, like, no understanding of people, whereas in the past he's had complete understanding of people.
Yeah. He's written more... I know that the temptation is to say that he's more alien, but I really think it's more that he's been written more actually as the godlike figure that he represents. Like I've said before, like the Doctor... And the Master are essentially, they're acting as gods, and humans that kind of encounter them, we're just sort of like, in a weird way, the humans, we're, in a weird way, humans are kind of like the fleeting ghosts that just sort of flitter through the Time Lord's existence. You know, everything's temporary, because they are basically, they're gods, they're immortal, near enough. They're going to be there forever. It's very Greek, and I think that's the way that. It's the way it's being played. It's some of it's been the last two. I think it's been dialed up a bit more. Impressive stuff. Very strong.
Very, very strong.
Were you expecting him to say that it was going to be Base Under Siege?
Yes.
Yeah. I did. I thought that'd been quite nice. That was great. I've not really got anything else to say. We can't, because it's the first part, same as before. You know, it's like, until we've seen the next part, we can't really say anything. I did like it. I thought it was cool. Mm. I tell you what.
It'd be easier to watch if it wasn't so late and I wasn't so tired.
It's very late now, isn't it? Yeah. Can I throw out, can I act as a bit of a Cassandra? Can I throw a, not the cast that was in there, but can I throw out a semi-prediction here? We know that the writing that the TARDIS can't translate, which obviously we saw in the same pit as well.
Well, why does he never just assume it's a scribble? Like,
yeah, because, well, it's been scratched in as well. The rest of it's all... Actually, it reminded me a bit of Quatermass in the Pit. I got...
Quatermass in the Hole.
In that you've got this this sort of buried thing, and then you have to find out about it afterwards. It was nice seeing him put all the pieces together and kind of uncover it as it was going on. But, here we go. I think that the process, this ghost process, must be reversible. And we know that Clara got infected as well, all right? Because we saw Clara's eyes, because you saw the shot of the eyes as the people were becoming almost all rewritten, okay? So it must be a reversible process. And I think that that's probably going to come in...
Maybe it's just really dark.
Oh, it could be. What, you mean this is it?
You want a grown-up Doctor Who?
Here's your grown-up Doctor Who. Stop your weeping. Yeah, okay. I think we'll have to wait until next week now to really find out what's going on with that properly. Mm. But that's good. That's not a bad position to be in. So are we going to make any noises? Or we just?
I thought the next time was bizarre. Just, you know.
Any noises?
No, I just thought I should, you know, fling that in.
Okay. Yeah. All right, okay, well, good. And on that bombshell, I don't know what noise to make. Sort of a bloop or something like that.
You can make that noise if you want to.
Thanks.
I overheard a conversation between some Doctor Who fans who were saying that Under the Lake must be set in the future because we don't have any underwater buildings. Well, they were wrong. We're going to be taking a look at a very exciting project where marine research is currently happening 18 metres below the surface of the water. Welcome to Stranger on the Shore. I'm looking around Aquarius, sited in the Florida Keys Marine Sanctuary off Key Largo. For 21 years, Aquarius has proven to be instrumental in the advancement of ocean research, especially in assessing long-time ecological changes and serving as a catalyst for development of the next generation of marine and extraplanetary explorers and exploration technologies. This is truly the stuff of science fiction and fantasy. From James Bond to Doctor Who, this is science reality. But it's nothing new. In 1957, Dr. George F. Bond led a team to create the first underwater habitat. It's not as simple as plonking a watertight shed with oxygen supply on the seabed. You have to consider the pressure from the water and various gases. To this end, this first pod was inhabited by rats. The first human base appeared in 1962 and was named Continental Shelf Station 1. It was placed 10 metres below the surface near Marseille and was home to two aquanauts for 7 days. New stations appeared on a yearly basis through the 1960s. Conshelf 2 in 1964 boasted an additional pod reaching 30 metres and was equipped with a submersible vehicle known as the Diving Saucer. Conshelf 3 in 1965 went to 102 metres. The US Navy developed sea labs through the late 1960s, which included a programme to train Tuffy, the bottlenose dolphin, how to ferry supplies and rescue distressed divers. By this time, NASA were working with other agencies on Tektite, where they successfully submerged a team for 58 days in preparation for the space programme. Undersea research centres sprang up through the 1970s like Barrett homes on a British greenbelt. The largest and most advanced complex was La Chalupa Research Laboratory. As research technologies advanced and money was diverted to other areas, the underwater base became a memory that became mixed with the world of fantasy. In 1985, however, La Chalupa became the ultimate fantasy dream when it was converted into a hotel where you can stay overnight for $675. In fact, there are sub-hotels everywhere from the Maldives to Sweden, featuring bars, restaurants and dance floors. 67 underwater research centres were created over the 50-plus years since the work of the first pioneers of undersea living. But now there is just one, the Aquarius. Operated by the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and is home to scientists who study there at 2-week intervals from April through to November, as long as hurricane season allows. Since 1993, the Aquarius Undersea Lab has supported 115 missions, producing over 300 peer-reviewed scientific publications, along with numerous popular science articles and educational programs. It also hosted 16 NASA astronaut training missions. Research at Aquarius has helped understand and manage coral reefs worldwide, as well as give us a long-term insight into the world's changing ecosystem. You can find out about the current projects at Aquarius, as well as see live video feeds at aquarius.fiu.edu. But what of the future? Will we see more underwater research centres? Well, yes, but not static ones. Sea Orbiter is a sleek above and below water vessel at 58 metres in height and 550 tonnes. Sea Orbiter will allow sub-aqua missions 24/7, and the future has truly arrived. For more information on the subjects covered in Stranger on the Shore, please check out www.oneworldoneocean.com and seaorbiter.com.
the second part of the story is set before, so it looks like we're going to get the history of the flooding of the little town and all that stuff.
I'm apprehensive about the next episode. I liked Under the Lake so much that I'm worried it'll be an anticlimax. Maybe as the Doctor's actions impact the future, maybe we'll flip back to the base and see that in real time, how things are changing.
The Doctor spouting lines like, "I have to die," are wonderful in trailers and are likely written with an eye on what might play well in a trailer, to tell you the truth, but they just ring hollow.
The part that excited me the most was seeing just a brief glimpse, and I paused. It looked like a claw of some sort holding this giant weapon.
I really enjoy it when there's quite clear time travel and you go in between two different times. So I think it's going to be exciting to see how the two work out.
You have been hearing Andy, Beth, Al, Rob, Little Burr, The Him, Lizzie, Alicia, Ian, Kit and Lex. You can find out all about us at the dwshow.net and find us on Twitter and Facebook by searching the DW Show. That's with a capital D and a capital W. And you can email us at hello@thedwshow.net. The DW is in capitals. Our theme tune is by Dominic Glynn and is available as part of the Gallifrey Mixes on Amazon and iTunes. Thanks for listening.
What an image to leave us on, though, that frightening image of the Doctor suspended in the ocean. Terrifying.
There's a lot that they didn't show in that. I know there's stuff coming up in the next one that we just haven't seen.
It's a three-parter and they just kept it really stum.
I have a suspicion that we might be ending the series on a three-parter.
Ooh.
Mm.
You're listening to the Doctor Who Review Show 2015.